Welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today is an Irish-born author who lives in Vancouver. Before writing her debut novel, Malarkey, she was a theatre school graduate who aspired to be an actor. Then her writing career exploded, and after an armful of awards, she's now written a second, very controversial book, Martin John, a darkly funny and complex work which challenges the reader and showcases the writer's extraordinary linguistic talent. Anna Kana Schofield, welcome. Thank you so much for coming in to Meet the Writers. Anna Kana, I want to go right back to your beginnings, because clearly by your accent you're Irish. I know that you live in Canada, and I know that when you were very young your father died, and I wonder how much of a defining incident that was in your work. You were just 6 years old at that time.
Yes, my father died in 1977. I've just written a very long essay, 7,500-word essay in a collection called Alchemy. And it's about the devaluing of the imagination. And it's about my writing process. And it explores how my writing process is governed by a relentless thanatophobia, which is the fear of dying. But I've got quite strong feelings about the conflation of the biography of the author with the work. And I feel quite strongly that women authors, especially emerging women writers, tend to be writing confessional essays about their backgrounds and their lives as the means to sell their books. And that suits marketing departments. And I'm completely opposed to it. So I prefer not to offer my biography and my background as the means to explain my work. Because I write about, you know, I've written a novel and it's about a man who has deviant sexual urges. And I made him up. And I wrote another piece in The Guardian in 2013 about this pressure that writers experience. And I think disproportionately women writers tend to cave in, or tend to, it's not that they cave in, maybe some of them do it completely comfortably, but I'm kind of uncomfortable with it. And I think the recent scandal around the outing of Elena Ferrante spoke a great deal to that kind of appetite. And I suppose I feel that the appetite that we need to cultivate is around literature, not around the cult of the author. Mm-hmm. But that said, obviously, now she says all that and then she goes straight into confessional mode. I suppose if your first introduction to life is that people die, that you're most significant guardians or the people that are there to protect you die, it's a pretty bleak prospect, but not unuseful for artistic explorations and interrogations because it's abrupt. And so you could, if you want to be all psychoanalytic, which I really wouldn't recommend with my work, because you would not want to be stuck in the lift with me. You know, there's a certain pattern in my prose that where I deploy something that I call abruptions, which are abrupt interruptions in the form of my books. And people's lives tend to be abruptly interrupted in my work. So, yeah, if you want to know that, you need to go and you need to buy this essay collection called Alchemy, because I deploy this. Well, you'll have to read it and see. But I talk actually about the death of my father in a very inverted way to illustrate the devaluing of the imagination. Mm-hmm. And I talk about how my writing life, my writing process is infused with a kind of desperate anxiety. It's actually a thanatophobia. So whenever I'm writing anything, and I'd like to, you know, add a caveat here that I wouldn't recommend anybody listening write novels in the way that I write or conduct themselves in the manner in which I conduct myself in the way that I make my work. Because whenever I'm writing anything, if it's a review, I always feel this strange, I haven't written anything. And I get lost. I get very, very lost. So in this essay, I equate that to being constantly buried. And that happens in the process of writing novels. So I'm writing a new novel, writing two novels actually at the moment. And I always hit this point of, I can't find any of the work. I don't know where it's gone. And I have this thing, oh, I haven't written anything. nothing written, and yet, you know, there's 100 pages.
Where does your writing come from? How did you start?
Well, I did go to theatre school for a few years in London, and then when I came out, I wrote a play. I moved back to Dublin, and I wrote a play about the life of Catherine Mansfield, but it was told through the eyes of a woman at the Dole office. So it was told through the eyes of a young Irish woman at the Dole office. And after that, I decided if I was going to be writing about a writer, possibly wanted to be a writer. I found it very, very frustrating, the lack of parts for women and the expectations. And I didn't really fit into kind of leading actress because I'm like short, a bit Balzacian looking. And I was always getting cast as these nurses in Shakespeare and, you know, kind of fabulous sort of roly-poly sorts of women. But, you know, I've got the body of an 8-year-old boy with boobs, basically, who drank too much Coke one summer. So I don't, you know, it's not, I can't even, and I'm short, you know, I'm a complete, you know, short person. I'm just not good looking enough to be either. I'm not interesting enough physically or visually. I found it very frustrating, and I actually hate collaboration. I realised I actually hate collaboration, and the reason I hate collaboration is that I don't want to be told you can or you can't do this based on somebody else's decision. And then there's a lot of stuff about social class within theatre and acting that I just thought was intolerable. I think that's changed because that would have been a long time ago, like at least more than, golly, about 25 years ago that I'm describing this experience. So I wrote this play. I think I like the solitary nature of being a novelist. And so then I took 10 years to write my first novel. Like I said, don't recommend anyone follow my example here. Like, I'm not a writer to base your writing practice upon. And in that time, I wrote 3 novels to write Malarkey, which was my first novel, which is about grief and sexuality and an older woman misbehaving in that realm. But to go back, of course, to your first point, which I, of course, nobly avoided, the first novel that I wrote was maybe a confrontation of grief. And then within that novel, and it was, you know, I'm interested in inversions. I wanted to write about a woman who wouldn't be sunk. And so I wrote this novel. It's a fragmented, fractured, and it's called Malarkey, a Novel in Episodes. And it was episodic, and I wanted to use that. The reason it took me so long to write that book was I had to find a form. And conventional narrative forms, sort of the middle brow novel, if you like, where it's lyrical and everything, you know, and it's very descriptive and shaped in paragraphs, just didn't. I could never contract my prose to fit it. And then I began to think more and more, what is the experience of grief? And that's what you need to reflect in the shape of the book. So it's very fragmented and deliberately fragmented to give the reader the experience of what it is to be grief-stricken as they read. And then in that novel, I put one single footnote which said, see Martin John, a footnote novel, which was absolutely pure devilment and self-provocation. Because, of course, I had no idea would I write this novel. But, you know, a bit cheeky that way.
Malarkey came out to fantastic reviews, but it was quite difficult to get it published.
Oh, in the UK? Yes, it took... It wasn't as difficult, weirdly, to get Malarkey published as Martin John, which is why it's been such a kind of vindication and an affirmation of how extraordinarily well this Martin John has done. Yeah, I mean, Malarkey, I mean, I do think it was kind of interesting. The only country that both novels sold in translation was Turkey. And I found that just fantastic because, of course, we have all these notions of Turkey. And yet that was the only country that was willing to translate Malarkey at all. Mm-hmm. And I have wondered if it is the fact that it's about an older woman's sexuality and it's pretty transgressive because basically it's about a mother reenacting a gay son's love ex, you know, against the background of the Iraq war and the infidelity of her husband. I'd like to point out, like, she's reenacting them with a Syrian security guard from a shop in a small town in rural Ireland. She's not acting them out with her son, just to be clear. And so, you know, it's basically a widow and it's got this homoerotic undertone. And somehow the intersection of sexuality and grief spoke to something. And it was, you know, I was nominated for 3 book prizes in North America, and I won 2 of them. And I managed to get my son's orthodontic treatment paid for, because otherwise he'd have been crooked teeth for the rest of his life. And yeah, and then I traveled on and off for 3 years to different festivals with that novel. And then I wrote Martin John. Martin John was much tougher. It went much, much further with form. And Martin John was published in North America in September of 2015. And by my standards, it went kind of stratospheric. You know? I mean, I live a pretty sedate, indoor, vitamin D-deprived existence. And that novel has taken me to China. It's here I am, rainy day in Baker Street.
Let's talk about the form, because I find the form absolutely fascinating. This is, you just need to look at the reviews to know, and indeed the nominations and the prizes that it's won, that it's a tour de force. It's an extraordinary book. And the way it's written is just so interesting. There isn't a word in there, I'm guessing, that hasn't been considered and considered again.
Yes, to a rather terrifying extent. And I documented that process in that essay that I keep babbling on about. But it gets to the stage where I know every line in that book for the first 86 pages, usually. This novel is about a mother and a son. And it's about a lot has been made of the fact that Martin John is a deviant, a sexual deviant, a sex offender. He's actually a flasher and a fritter, but he has some quite violent deviant sexual urges. And an awful lot is made of that content, if you like, although the form of my novels is the content. But not enough has really been made of the fact that he's a disturbed boy, and that disturbed boys, if we're not attentive to them, become disturbed men, and they do disturbing things to women disproportionately and increasingly men. And so I think that that's more interesting, really. Mm. And the novel is about the mother and the sorts of dilemmas that we have as mothers. And so 2 of the philosophical starting points for me, or, you know, because I always have sort of interrogative questions that I'm trying to poke. I don't resort to didacticism. I don't tell you how to think about Martin John. I don't tell you how to feel about him. And I don't tell you how I feel about him, really. I just posit these scenarios, and then the reader comes and completes the scenario. But I wanted to look at 2 things. I wanted to look at whether it was possible to love your child to the point of destroying them. And these were questions kind of relate to both novels. The second question less so to Malarkey. And the second point was very, very important to Martin John was, is it unreasonable that a mother may protect her child to the detriment or sacrifice of another person's or mother's child? So that was one thing. Then I had to think about, you know, I really increasingly think we've moved too far away from the awareness or understanding that the role of art, and especially literature, is to interrogate and to respond. And so the time period in recent history, there's just been, I feel like the lid has been lifted as far as the 70s and the 80s, and some of this deep, deep psychosexual problems, not to suggest that they're in any sense gone or, but there's just been an awareness.
Particularly within the church and so on.
Yeah. And Jimmy Savile.
Yeah.
But the church was, yes, the clerical sexual abuse reports. And I just do feel that this is a defining conversation for women of my generation. Mm. So there was this strange sense of, okay, if I go to put another novel into the world, I've got to respond on some level to something related to sexual assault and sexual abuse, because it's something like 1 in 3 women now. And so it just seemed unconscionable not to respond. So, I mean, it's not easy to write a novel that challenges. So your question actually was about the form of the novel, and it's a great question, and thank you so much for asking it, because it's a question I'm thirsty for. I'm actually parched for this question, even though it's taken me like now 14 days to answer this question. I always begin with form. I thought, okay, I have this man who is in compulsive cycles, and he's got these urges, and there's a cycle of reoffending. And then there's the cyclical nature of mental illness, and the fact that it repeats and it loops. And then there's this other question of complicity, which is also cyclical. Mm-hmm. And somehow I knew that the novel would have to be circular. And that also is a point of social class with my work, that the people that I write about, like the mother in this novel, her life will not add up in neat narrative arcs, and she will have to resolve to carry on living a quietly miserable life, aware that her son is deeply deranged and dangerous, and that she can't fix him. And that's the mother throughout the novel just wants him to stop it, and that's how she responds to his behaviour rather than... And how would she have had the means to... I mean, this was a time when I don't think women were believed, or men for that matter, because we have to not be disingenuous to the male experience of sexual assault. So I had to find a form that would be circular, would need to be hermetic because of the secretive nature of all of this. And also, you know, shame, these kind of dichotomy of courage and shame. And I think actually in the last month, I realised like how potent this intellectual inquiry to shame is in my work. And so it has to be hermetic, because shame is something that's hermetically sealed inside you. And so the novel unrolls in a very hermetic way, and it responds unto itself within itself. That's how the form of the book is.
And the point of view changes around, doesn't it? I mean, that's so interesting.
Yeah, and in fact, it's so interesting because, you know, when you write these books, you're not conscious really of what you're doing. Well, I'm not anyway. So Martin John, we hear, so his mother's in his head, but even though the mother comes through, we meet the mother through Martin John's thoughts, we also know how she feels about certain things. And I of course, didn't, you know, I didn't consciously sit down and try to create this device, but I've happened upon it. Mm. And now when I think about it, I was thinking, wow, that's kind of interesting. That's very innovative, even though, you know, I'm not sure that innovation is always, you're not cognizant of innovation. You're just responding to language and finding the language to get underneath. And that's what interests me, is getting underneath, not on top. Mm. Because a more traditional approach would be that I would heap description of surroundings and people, and you would meet this character in that way. And I don't do that. I go kind of underneath and up through their toes and into their kidneys and out through the orifices that we tend not to wish to encounter. Mm.
And you do another thing that isn't generally done, which is you kind of break that fourth wall, that the reader becomes almost complicit, really.
Yeah, and that's that circle that I described about complicity. So I'm demanding an awful lot of the reader in my work, and I'm aware of that. And it's a very interesting relationship I have with my readers, because, of course, you really treasure your readers. When people come and they meet you on the page and they are willing to engage, I can't tell you, writers are nothing without their readers. So this was actually a Brechtian thing, because Brecht used to do this. He used to do the direct address. And I wanted to do that. So there's just a couple of times throughout the narrative, I directly address the reader and I ask the reader, well, what would you do if this was your son? And then another time I say, you know, this hasn't been an easy novel for any of us. I want the reader to be very deeply invested in this work. And I also want the reader to know that I'm aware of how they're working. Mm-hmm. And again, that's a philosophical question of, you know, Martin John is us. You know, we like to think of people who have deviant sexual urges as some very distant aberration. And as long as we continue to do that, we recoil from them. You know, we are, in essence, complicit in that cycle. And, you know, we are also abandoning victims. In distancing ourselves from that, we're also distancing ourselves from the experience of victims. And one of the critical things throughout the novel, because, of course, making a choice to write from the point of view of the male rather than the victimized woman, you know, as a woman, there are kind of moral and ethical dilemmas for me. But what I've done is injected female resistance throughout the novel. And unfortunately, I think it's being missed a little bit. And increasingly, I'm aware that that would be precisely what the victim's experience is. Because it's, again, it's to address shame and where that sits in you as the woman violated. Mm-hmm. And you aren't out professing and announcing how you feel. You carry that in corners of yourself, and it manifests as there's one almost like a slight monologue from the point of view of a victim of Martin Johns. And it's something like in the gaps is where she remembers. And it describes how this young woman has two children and she never lets her daughters stay at the home of anybody else. And it talks about how she hung on to. So earlier in his life when he was a younger boy, maybe in the sort of 10 to 12 year old. Well, I'm very vague with ages, so the reader can decide. But he's young when he does this. He punches a girl in the vagina in the dentist's waiting room. And this is a pivotal, you know, it's one of the most deviant things that he does. And so the character, the victim, the young woman, is that woman as a mum, a young mum. And she is holding on to the fact that he did not get a direct hit because she had fabric between. And I feel like that's the moment that women carry for the rest of their lives. It's like, well, because you've got to find something to hold on to because you've got nothing. And so it would have been a falsehood. I, again, it's form. It's like, okay, I want to find a form to interrogate what it is to be a victim, to be deeply injured and traumatized, and how that will carry you through your life. As in, you'll stuff like, you know, if you're moving into an apartment, you will get the apartment near the front door so you can get out. Or, you know, you're always aware of your surroundings and you're always assessing the possible danger of the people, the men you encounter, if you've had an experience like that. Or I don't actually think there's many women who haven't been flashed. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, and you know, Twitter if I'm wrong, but
we've all experienced it to some degree, haven't we?
Well, we know that man. Yeah. We know that man. He's looking at us on the bus. He's looking at us on the tube, and so in a way, I guess it was sort of like injections. That the victim's perspective is the resistance, the female resistance is in this novel, and it's injected at certain points. He doesn't get the reaction. At one point, he flashes a young girl, woman, young woman in the street, and he's followed her, and she doesn't respond to him, and he's devastated. You know, he's broken because, of course, he's after the thrill. And there's another time on the tube where a woman grabs him by the throat and he says, I didn't think women could do that. So it is in there, but it was very important, you know, like I really had to step up because I wanted to turn away because it's not comfortable to do this kind of writing. And in fact, physically, it was very hard on me. I developed almost like adult tic disorder from writing this book. I actually had a couple of seizures. See, here I go, damning the confessional and then confessing. Maybe because psychologically it was disturbing. But it's very important that we women writers do the dirty work that the novel requires, this kind of novel. I can, if you like, wimp out and make it nicer, but there's nothing nice. There's nothing nice about if some predator comes after you or some person attacks you, there's nobody to make that nicer. Mm. And so literature, it must respond. I guess it's the whole form is content thing.
I'm wondering about reaction to this. Now, you mentioned Twitter and the fact that you may be pilloried for various things. And I know that you're sensitive because you have been. And several people have said to you in the public, this is a novel about paedophilia. And this is why are you empathising so much with this deviant? And I feel that you've been attacked a lot about the point of view you've taken, that, as you say, people are perhaps missing that the female resilience in there too.
Well, I have to admit, I thought it'd be a lot worse in terms of I thought this novel would ruin me. And I think a lot of the time it's a misunderstanding. Most of the time people haven't actually opened the novel. And there's just, and again, if I wrote a novel that you didn't recoil from about a man with deviant sexual urges, I would have failed as a novelist. There's a lot of humour in this novel.
Yes.
Which, again, I don't, it hasn't been that bad. Strangely, in England, it's been different. I never got any of that in Canada, in North America. I never got that. Although, okay, you know, it's interesting. Actually, journalists, some journalists would want to know why did you write a novel about a sexual offender or a sexual deviant? And first of all, Mark John is not a paedophile. So that's just absolute, that's actually misinformation. He's not a paedophile.
And it is never defined,
yeah,
is it? Which it, is so interesting.
Yes. Yeah, there's this thing that I use throughout. There are five refrains as well that he uses to deflect his actions. And then I use the word it in italics throughout, which is, of course, it is his act of taking out his penis and flashing and rubbing up against women and just that behavior. So I think what is interesting is this notion or this sort of suggestion that because, I mean, it's kind of gender, that because I'm a woman writer, I owe an additional justification for creating this challenging work. And of course, I utterly reject that. And I would argue, why does Philip Roth get to write these books? Why, you know, we don't assume that Kafka, you know, donned a Beatle outfit and went and lived under the sink. We don't ask him to justify. But at the same time, I'm cognizant of the fact that it's not unreasonable for people to ask those questions. Well, actually, what am I saying? It is unreasonable. But I've got to be prepared to answer them because I put a piece of art in the world that people are responding to. And actually, for the most part, we do underestimate readers. I mean, I've only really had one person who suggested, rather strangely, that I was promoting rape culture or something, which was, I think, again, a miss. You know, I don't know if the person actually read the novel because it certainly isn't. I mean, you know, it's very tricky. I do think there's something gendered in it, but I'm prepared to do difficult work. I want to do difficult work. And like Blanchot has a line about the writer being the first reader of the work. And as this wonderful road that I'm walking and rocky and with a bit of inclement weather sometimes continues, I learn so much from readers and from readers' responses. So, of course, I would never want to shape those responses.
Mm. You said a little bit earlier that you were making art, and I just can't recommend it too highly to everybody to say that this amazing book, Martin John, really is a work of art. So, Anna Kena Schofield, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Martin John by Anna Kena Schofield is published by And Other Stories. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to production team of Cy Villaferte and Claire Urban. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.